Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Let's face it, the future is now. We're living in a connected cyber society, and we need to stop ignoring it or pretending that it's not affecting us. Join us as we explore how humanity arrived at this current state of digital reality and what it means to live amongst so much technology and data. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. RSA Security offers business-driven security solutions that provide organizations with a unified approach to managing digital risk that hinges on integrated visibility, automated insights, and coordinated actions. Learn more at rsa.com. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
There we go. Straight off the bat, there's a horn talking to me.
I thought you actually did that on purpose. You have some special effect machine right there.
I waited for the horn to drive by. No, Marco, I mean, there is a lot of communication going on outside here, but I have something to say to you.
Yeah, how you want to say that?
You're not going
to person, face to face?
You're not going to No, it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. You'll have to decipher it some other way. No, I think this conversation really is a conversation about conversing with each other, but perhaps not always directly, as you so pointedly alluded to there, Marco.
Yeah, I mean, especially lately, there is a lot less of that conversation. Yes. And a lot of more of this
Not many handshakes happening to set the stage for what's going to be said right after the handshake.
That's right.
This is the world we live in, and tomorrow it's going to be different. And the things we say and the things we hear and what we try to convey with how we interact with each other looks different today than yesterday, and it's going to look different in the future. And that's what I think. I'm excited about this conversation to dig into linguistics.
Linguistic. And as you said, you know, it's going to change, but it's always going to be there because communication is one of those very pillar that make ourselves humans. And we're going to look back a little bit, actually a lot, maybe in the history, and then to see how where we are now and technology is affecting the way that we communicate, how we change with technology as we actually create it. So to do that, of course, as usual, Sean and I don't know much about it. So we bring somebody that knows, is a professor of linguistic. Her name is Valerie Friedland, and she teaches at the University of Reno, Nevada, and writes also for Psychologist Today and a lot many more things that maybe she should tell us in person. Welcome, Valerie.
OMG, Valerie.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited to be here and have this conversation because I think it's a fun one. Everybody talks, right? Everybody communicates, so it's relevant to everybody, but also an important one because things are changing so drastically in the world, and our whole way of communicating has been sort of dealt a blow lately and shifted to a completely different format, making us interact through machines in a way we hadn't before. So I think it's an interesting question how that changes how we speak. But if we look back through time, we see that language has endured much more in terms of chaos and disaster than this. So I think if we're still talking today, we'll still be talking tomorrow. But as you said, I'm a linguist. My particular specialty is a really hard word to say, so I always enjoy making other people say it, but I'll let you off the hook this time. It's a sociolinguist, and that doesn't mean I am a linguist that really likes to party. It's actually that I'm a linguist that looks at the intersection between how we communicate from a cognitive and articulatory standpoint. So sort of the physiological and cognitive architecture behind how we speak and how we interact from a social standpoint. So linguistics as a field looks at sort of the brain and the mouth. So how we construct language as an individual speaker. But a sociolinguist looks at, okay, once it's out of your mouth, how does it affect the way that we engage? How does it affect the communication we have? And how does the form of communication we're having actually then circle back and affect the cognitive and physiological structures? So I'm interested in, you know, that's a big way of describing that I'm interested in the way that humans actually interact and engage linguistically. So that's sort of the gist. But I think when people think about linguistics, they think about words a lot of times. So you see a lot of discussion about new COVID terms, for example, and where they come from, or different new markers people are using, like, for example, the discourse marker like. That's a big one in terms of how we communicate in modern times. But actually, linguists are really interested in much more fine-grained differences than that. We're also interested in those questions, but what people don't tend to see is the behind-the-scenes stuff that goes into how we talk. And we do all these decisions in a split second when we're about to say something. We have to decide what are the sounds that we need to make to say this word. How are those sounds going to be affected by where the word is in the stream of speech? If I have several different vocabulary items to choose from, which one am I going to choose? So, for example, will I say damn or darn? I have both as part of my repertoire, as part of my basic semantic ability. But how I choose that will depend on who I am as a speaker, so my social facts, and where I am as a speaker, meaning the context. So we can see how these things all interact. Also, the choice between whether I say I will do that or I'm going to do that. We don't tend to stop and think, huh, what should I say? Will or going to? How am I feeling today? But we say one, we say it like this. And we alter which one we say, again, depending on who we are as a social person, in terms of our social identity, and where we are in terms of our position in the world, our physical place in the world, and various things like that. So all of these different levels of linguistics are the types of things that really are important to building our social identity and also how other people perceive us, but we don't tend to think of those things when we go into a conversation. So that's basically the gist.
I feel like a sociopath linguist.
I have had students that have accused me of that. Oh, you're a sociopath linguist. I try to clarify.
Well, you know, there is many things you can make fun of. You know, the grammar police, the people that always pay attention to all the little detail, the use of it when you write it. But when we talk, we're a lot more flexible. And especially if you come from another country, then you can get away with a murder because maybe it's not your first language. So that's my excuse all the time. Not my first language. But all that you said, I think it kind of cover the first question that I was going to ask you, which is kind of like, you know, defining what the study of the, you know, linguistic is. And the application is incredible. It's part of who we are. So if we look back, and by back, I mean from the time that we will grunt at each other and then actually, you know, employing things maybe to the point where the language became something that without it, we wouldn't be who we are from an anthropological perspective.
Right. And I have a quick question before you go there, Valerie, if I may. Does it have to be sound? Because I know not everybody can make sounds?
No. Language, right? When we talk about language, we're talking about all sorts of language. So sign language is exactly the same from a cognitive standpoint as any other human language. So it's more typical, of course, that people use an oral language, but sign language is also has very similar development. So for example, when you bring a bunch of children together that might not have had a shared language who are deaf, what we find in deaf schools where this was the established procedure, you know, all of a sudden they brought deaf children together that formerly had not been together and had no sign language, they developed their own sign language into a full-fledged language, which is exactly what children do. As you know, when they're born, they develop language from the pieces they hear around them, and they bring them together. And Creole languages are built very much like sign languages. So when you have these disparate pieces and you put them together, and then a native generation is born into these two language groups, they will often take a pidgin language and develop into a full-fledged language, which is a Creole. And sign language is very much the same thing. So we're talking about all languages, whether oral or sign.
And facial expression and everything that's around us, the our body position, that's we're really good at reading all of that. But right. The language...
Virtual communication, that makes that harder.
Right. But the language, spoken language, is what allowed to communicate far away, maybe when people don't see us. And then you can talk about way that we have developed, and I'm getting to technology here, to communicate longer distance. And absolutely. Then the writing, and then on, the telegraph, and the semaphore, and all of that. And we get to where we are today, where, as you were mentioning at the beginning, technology has become such a important part of the way we communicate and the way we change how to communicate. So I like today to focus on that. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm very fascinated by the history of all of this, I would like to point how maybe the internet itself, the text messaging, all the social media, and also, yeah, interacting and asking Siri or Alexa something that still sound weird to me when I do that, to be honest with you. But how has this changed us? And has it changed it for the better or for the worst?
Well, let me unpack those into several different questions.
Yes, please. But, I know it was a lot.
and the first thing is, throughout time, every time we've had radical change, people have wondered if this is going to be a bad thing or a good thing. And then if we think about where we are today, we rarely think we're worse off than we were in the time of Chaucer, right? But people are always thinking back to, oh, the good old days, there's a golden era, and sort of this fantasy we have that language hasn't changed and that society hasn't changed over time. And actually, in the last 300 years, we, from a linguistic standpoint, have changed much less than the first 1,000 years. So between Old English and early modern English, the language changed drastically, much more than it has changed in the last several hundred years. And that wasn't just because people decided to do different things. It's because different major catastrophic events occurred that caused that to change. We, you know, had a lot of invasions and the Black Plague and all these other things that changed how people could communicate. So I think we have to, you know, be careful not to have what's called the recency illusion, which is the idea that things today are so drastically different than they were yesterday. The form of change today is different, but the idea of change isn't. So, you know, from a standpoint of history, I don't think we have to worry that we're not going to communicate effectively because of these new forums. But I do think we have an adjustment period where we have to get used to them on two levels. And here's where I think there's two different things in the question that you asked that are important. One is simply that we're using different formats to communicate. And anytime we do that, we have to say different things. So to look back at another example, think about the invention of the telephone. When that was a revolutionary device to allow us to communicate to people that weren't immediately in our presence, right? So we could call people that were far away. So if you do that, you have to think, okay, well, how do I get someone's attention if I'm trying to call them, right? How do I get someone's attention? Well, before it rings, what we do is say something. And that's sort of how hello came to be. And hello didn't exist in the way that we use it today as a greeting prior to phones. Now, the word existed. It existed as a sort of word of surprise, especially in British English, like, hello, what happened there? And then it became used to communicate over long distances as an attention getter. So here's a interesting way that language evolved because of the technology that evolved. Now, an interesting side note there is ahoy was another front runner in how to communicate. And in fact, if you watch The Simpsons, there's a character that still answers the phone with Ahoy, because there was a actually big battle back in the day between the invention, when the telephone was invented, between those that were proponents of saying Ahoy to get attention and those that were hello speakers. And obviously we see which one won out, since we're not saying hello today, Ahoy today. But again, you see how this intersection affected the way we speak. So now texting, let's think about texting. Similarly, it's a new way we have to figure out how to communicate. And so the constraints of the device, much like the constraints of a phone, caused us to have to come up with other ways of communicating. Text limits, in this case, in early texting, right, was really the rise of acronyms, the rise of abbreviated forms, the rise of using, you know, the number four for the word four, because we had text character limits. And that interacted with the way we communicated, so that now we don't have textual limits, we don't have character limits anymore, but we still use those new types of communicative devices to help us communicate. So something that arises because of the format of the new technology sometimes then stays with us. We forget why we did it in the first place, and it's just some part of our new form of communication. The question, of course, people ask is, well, since we do all these weird texting symbols and we don't use punctuation and we're using, you know, abbreviations for everything, is this going to affect literacy? There's been a number of studies, and it has been found that actually it doesn't, because what are we doing more than we used to? We're writing more, because it may not be the writing of a formal standard written English, but it's writing of a hybrid style where kids used to interact through just oral messages. So literacy actually seems to be aided because of this early form, proto-literacy, that young children are getting on text messaging. So here's an example of a format that has caused us to change the way we communicate because of its early limitations, that now has actually aided children in gaining some early phoneme, grapheme correspondence in literacy.
And I don't know if you mentioned it before we started recording, Valerie, but you said your kids don't know what voicemails are and really don't use phones to communicate. So they're using text messaging and social apps to connect and communicate with each other. And I'm wondering, are you seeing people speak to, we haven't gotten into the Siri and the assistant part yet, but I know we're using our devices and speaking to them. So we'll get to that in a second. But in terms of texting, you said people are typing. Are they really typing, or are they speaking to their device and it's typing for them? Do you have a sense for that?
I think only old people like me talk to them, because I'm not good typing to get it to do the text to speech translation. My kids text, and they somehow do it really rapidly with their thumbs, so that it's basically as fast as I can type. They're thumbing it, whereas I sit there with my one finger and text it out. So I think it's only people like me that actually use the auto transcribe function. My kids actually, to my great dismay, text. They don't answer phone calls. They don't even know how to use their voicemail. And I see this as something pretty prevalent with their peer group. And in fact, I have a younger brother who's in his 30s, and he also doesn't. I never even bother with voicemails for him, because all it means to him is, oh, my sister called. I see that on the voicemail function. I'll text her. So no, I think we are really in a different era because of the advantages afforded through texting, which are also, on the flip side, it's disadvantaged, but the advantage is that it's a very quick way to communicate. So the social interactions that you have to do when you talk to someone face-to-face or over a phone, hello, how are you? How's it going? Other chit-chat before we get down to the business of why I called, is not necessary over texting. And so from a business standpoint and from a social standpoint, it's a lot more efficient because of that. Of course, it's also the downfall of sort of that type of phatic communication. But I think when we're in person, we still do that. And maybe we're just evolving to know that that's not necessary all the time, as long as we also maintain it in our face-to-face communication. So children are not unversed in being civil. You know, that's a parent problem, not a kid problem if they are. They're just versed in having these understandings of where it's appropriate and where it's not necessary. And so they've evolved to have these sort of bilateral venues in which to communicate in different ways.
And So on the same topic, because you mentioned business, and I'm picturing kids, their own peer group, interact a certain way, their parents interact with different mediums in certain ways, and that's all in the personal life arena, let's say. And I'm wondering, are we going to continue to see pockets of those peer group communications, and how does that change when I'm just thinking about the next generation moving into business? Let's say a big four company or one of the Fortune 100 companies, your top executive, are you doing OMGs through text to close a big deal? Or does it change the business communication as well eventually as the next generation comes up?
I think a little bit of both. You know, a lot of times one of the most common concerns I have expressed to me when I give talks and I'm talking about all the new language that's coming up. And in fact, I'm writing a book on just this topic because of the people that come up to me after talks is, oh my gosh, my kids are not going to know how to be professional. They don't sound professional. They don't interact in a professional manner. They're going to bring this with them. I'd say two things to that. One is there's something called age grading, which is well studied in linguistics. And age grading is simply that we don't use the same language to communicate with our peers as teenagers as we do to communicate when we become adults. And a lot of features that we use disappear or dissipate over time as we go into different life cycles. We are very flexible in terms of recognizing the social needs at the moment. So when, for example, like use is one of those age graded features. A lot of people are a little worried about it. I get a lot of parents asking me about their child's incessant like use. And to them, I would say that it A is much more functioning than you tend to think. There is actually a really interesting literature behind why we have seen this rapid uptake in like use over time. But second, that if you look at the literature on like use that has studied it through different age groups, it lessens as children get older. So the peak of use tends to be children under 12, actually. And then they continue to use it at a higher rate, but not quite as high as they go through high school and middle school. But then it does rapidly lower or lessen as they go into adulthood. Of course, it doesn't go away altogether. So that gets to the second part of your question. Are we going to see this follow them up? Yes, to some degree. Whatever becomes new in one generation, at some level, often follows that generation and then their kids and then their kids up to be the new norm. But this is how history has worked. So many, many things that we're saying today were things that, you know, 50 years ago, the parents worried about us using. So if, for example, just using the intensifier quite, that was quite a good show, right? Or something, or he did quite well on the exam. If I said that about my children, they would think I sounded old fashioned, but quite was considered a vulgar adverb about 100 years ago. So I think we tend to be blindsided by our moment rather than look back at our past. And so, yes, some of them will follow us. So like use, for example, is something that now you can hear in people in their 40s and 50s. But do you hear it as prevalently? No. And in many, many business contexts in which I give workshops that are professionals at high levels, I hear like use in the questions or when they discuss things with each other, but it's not at a rate anywhere near what adolescents use it at. So it has lessened as those people have aged up to the point where we don't even notice it anymore. In 50 years, we won't notice it at all. So yes, I think there's a little bit of both. There is a adolescent peak, we call it, where new features or new forms coming into language have the most heightened use. And then that serves as the model to the next generation, so they use it. And then as you age into adult life circumstances, a linguistic market, you could call it, where that kind of speech won't work, you see that it lessens over time. Sometimes it goes away completely, but more often when it has a high degree of use in adolescence, it decreases to a point where it doesn't become as salient, and then over time we don't even notice it anymore. Does that answer your question, Sean?
It does, it does. And I can't help but think that we've become lazy, because I'm remembering like for sure, like for sure, like Valley Girl kind of thing. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, because you're from LA.
So. from LA, exactly. No. Frank Zappa, that song. That's anyway.
Well, what's funny, just a little aside with that is everybody thinks Like is a Valley Girl feature, but actually it's a British feature that we see in speakers in the late 1800s, used much the same way that it is used as a discourse marker today. There is a really lovely body of recordings of New Zealanders that were done in the 1950s that were elderly at the time, meaning they were born in the late 1800s. They use Like as a discourse marker. It's not highly salient. People didn't notice it at the time, but actually the roots of Like probably go much further back, hundreds of years, than we tend to think of it. So Valley Girls were just the people that happened to be caught using it because they had a lot of other salient features, not the ones that actually invented it.
All right, let's get techie.
Okay, let's do it.
Time to tech.
So I think we have to accept, and we know that dictionary changed. There's new versions. Words fall out of the usual usage and in the common usage, and others pick up. I remember having, like you said, conversation with my parents back in the days, like, what does it mean? It's kind of like a slang that then take over and then you drop again. But now we're facing something that I don't think is just generational. It's driven by technology itself. So I always like to think about that famous quote from Mark Twain that says, I wrote you a long letter because I didn't have time to send you a short one, to write a short one. And it's so true. When we write, you know, you want to cut all the unnecessary thing. And I feel like sometimes with the technology, like texting, for example, or talking to your personal assistant, we are adopting maybe a more efficient way to communicate. That's kind of my question for you. But also, how now that we go into artificial intelligence and speech recognition and we want something that passed the Turing test in sounding like human, not only because it says something, but actually how it says something, so conceptualize the understanding of what is written, what is said. How do you see these things moving? And are we better communicator? Are we gonna get better communicator because we can be more efficient in doing that instead of that chit-chatting in person that you said? Like, what the future looks like for you?
You know, I think that's a very good question. And obviously none of us can know what the future will bring, especially—
I do.
Well, then I'll let you answer. When you look at what's happened today and how we have become so tied to our devices to communicate, even when we are doing face-to-face, but look at how that has evolved because of the value of face-to-face communication. We didn't just call each other, we're actually looking at each other. So technology has kept up with our desire to have face-to-face interaction. Because we need it. It's valuable to us as humans, and I don't think we'll ever lose that. But I do agree that there has been a fundamental shift in the style of communication. And so I think that's important to think of it as a stylistic difference rather than a gain or a loss. One thing is we have become more informal in our communications, especially in the last 2 years, because we are, you know, speaking from our homes, our lives are on display. So it makes sense to not be overly formal. It would be weird to have your dogs barking, your baby crying, doing a meeting and try to use will, shall, and must not. It just doesn't work. So, you know, we've become more informal because of the format. We've also become more informal because over the last several hundred years, the norms of politeness have fundamentally changed from something that was a discernment politeness based on rank. Social order was very important in the Middle Ages and early modern period. Who you were, how you were born, what you were born into. You couldn't escape. There was no social mobility. But with the Industrial Revolution and even the Black Death, we saw a massive restructuring of society that altered the fundamental social order. And that shifted our politeness. That's really what triggered this change towards a more informal politeness, because we didn't have these very rigid structures of, here's this, you know, guy that's above me, and I'll never, ever gain any kind of stature in his eyes. So I have to be extremely polite because he'll crush me. He'll kick me off his land. You know, and that kind of thing. We didn't have any choices. And so the kinds of politeness was really determined by the social structure between you. But now we have a very fluid, much more socially mobile structure. So part of what comes with that is that we also want to be friendly. If, you know, you were living on my land and working it and I was the lord, I really didn't need to be nice to you. And it didn't even occur to me that I should. But we have a quid pro quo kind of thing going on nowadays, where we understand that you get more with honey than with vinegar. And so part of that is this necessity for phatic communication. So in some ways you could say that this phatic communication, this friendliness, this interactivity is actually fairly new because of the change in our social structure. So we existed without it for a long time because we were only polite to those we had to be polite to. Now we're polite to everybody. So politeness norms, I don't think you could say they've gotten worse. Maybe the internet has certainly changed how they get broadcast. And I think that's what people most notice, is that what you say gets broadcast to millions versus just to the three people that were in your neighborhood before. And this has fundamentally changed, I think, how we have to watch what we say. So there's really a weird competition between this informality that these new styles of speaking give us. You know, we're texting, we're doing short forms, we're kind of informal, we have a more informal culture. And then this weird, oh, I don't know who's going to hear what I say, so I better read my tweets over five times so I don't tweet something that's going to get me into trouble. So, you know, I think we tend to focus on one side versus the other, but we actually have both pressures on us. In terms of how this will carry on to the future, I don't see us getting more formal. I think we've all appreciated that there's a little more flexibility in our social rank that it affords us this informality. But I also think we recognize that there are cases and places where it's called for. And I think that's the big concern for people. Not that we can be more informal with each other, and maybe we don't use some of these overt politeness markers we used to, but we worry, will our children know, and I think this is something Sean sort of asked about, will our children know when they go work for that Fortune 500 company that that's not an appropriate, tweeting your boss is not an appropriate way to interact with them. And I would say that for the vast majority of times, yes, I think we are very good at understanding that there are particular styles of language useful in particular places. And children still go to school, and in those schools, they learn formal interactions. And so that is what they carry forward. So you have to remember there's two pressures on us. There's the solidarity pressure that's about being friends with people and having them like you. And then there's the sort of competence pressure. There's the social prestige pressure, and that's about having people impressed by you. And we still have those two pressures that are competing for our attention. And the only difference is when we're, you know, under 18, the solidarity pressure is much more important to us than the social prestige pressure from a professional standpoint. But when we go to college and we're looking for a job, really, very few people do not recognize that there is a completely different, more formal standard in play in those contexts. So to answer the question of what the next, you know, 20 years will look like, do I think we'll be more formal than we were 50 years ago? I think we already are. Do I think that recognizing code switching is relevant in certain contexts professionally? I think that for most people that interact in those contexts, who train for those contexts, that is part of what they're learning as they go through school. Does that answer your question, Marco?
It does. Yes.
and I think I'm going to let it Sean, but in my head, I'm very futuristic and sci-fi oriented. So I'm thinking like how we will interact with our personal assistant that, let's face it, right now they're not that smart, but they will get better, and maybe interacting with robots. And are we going to be formal with them? How would they recognize the evolution of the language? Are they constantly updating? Can they be able eventually to look at our facial expression, me being Italian and moving my hands, or, you know, how I think this is where we understand how we are complicated machines as human, I guess.
Absolutely. That's a really interesting question, because the last 5 years has seen a complete evolution of how computers are going to interact with us and how well they're going to interact with us. 10 years ago, voice recognition was really bad, really bad. So, you know, digital assistants were not really even a thing yet because they couldn't communicate with us well. But now with natural language processing, where basically computers teach themselves, it is skyrocketing, the advances. The huge training data that has become available for us to teach computers on, and the algorithms that we're able to write now in computational linguistics that let computers teach themselves, tell us that they will actually keep up with us quite well. And if you look just in the last few years, I just actually reviewed a paper for a technology journal in linguistics that was comparing voice recognition programs from 5 years ago and how well they performed with modern voice recognition programs. And they performed at about a 50% recognition rate for a very standard dialect. This is the other part of the puzzle we'll have to talk about. About 5 years ago, they were up to about 70 to 80% now. So that's a huge leap in 5 years. And a lot of that through natural language processing. And sometimes we don't even know how it's working. It's that little black box, right? The idea that it goes in and it comes out and it can tell us things. Not only can it tell us what we're saying well, but it also can do sentiment analysis. So it can tell whether we're happy or sad. It can tell also just looking through, you know, blogs, for example, what kind of blogs they are in terms of, you know, are they, if it's about a product, are they good reviews? Are they bad reviews? Because they have learned to recognize linguistic markers of negativity and linguistic markers of positivity. So the advances have been huge. And I think we're still going to have some of the basic problems we have in terms of the last little bit of voice recognition for a number of years, at least based on the experts I've spoken with. But we will, as normal lay people, hardly notice it. So your Alexa or your Siri is just going to keep improving. That said, how many times have you talked to Alexa or Siri and she says, I don't understand you. Would you like me to do a search for that? It still happens pretty frequently. And what we don't tend to realize is when we talk to a digital assistant, we're pretty limited in what we say to it. So the things they're programmed to understand are in a narrow range. And that's why they seem pretty good at it, because, you know, there's only so many things we're going to ask for, like toilet paper and looking up, you know, the weather and what's the air quality index, which is something very relevant to my part of the world these days with the fires. So as long as you are circumscribed in what you're telling it to look for, it's going to perform very, very well. When you have larger computer systems for corporations, for example, when they have huge amounts of training data, they can perform better. But Siri and Google assistants are still on that sort of more limited circumscribed set. So those, I think, we'll see some improvements in the next 10 years. And in fact, I believe Google just had an assistant that passed the Turing test, where it made phone or answered phone calls, and it actually responded in real time to those phone calls, and people did not realize they were talking to a digital assistant. That's the part we're not quite at yet with Alexa and Siri. When you talk to them, you completely know by the way they answer you that they're machines. I think in 5 to 10 years, that will be changing. And it's changing at an incredibly rapid pace with the amounts of data that we have to throw at the problem now. The bigger problem is representation, because think of the types of training data we're using for all those programs. Probably not as many Italian speakers, Marco, as English speakers. So you're going to find that there is a bias inherent in those systems that they perform better for speakers of large language groups, for example, and speakers of standard dialects of those large language groups. So that same study I told you about that had a much higher rate of recognition compared to 5 years ago, it still performed really badly at recognizing non-standard dialects of English. So things like Southern speech, its recognition was back at about a 55-60% rate. Women's speech seems to be recognized at a lower rate as well, because again, the training data is preponderantly male. So we see these are the problems that we're going to have to surmount. We will be able to be understood by our computers and they will understand us as long as we're speakers of the big five languages, as long as we're speakers of the standard language. But for minority languages and dialects, it's going to actually widen the gulf in the future.
Yeah, there's also the financial element there. And I know we're, for those who can afford Siri and those that can't, right? excuse me, we're getting close to the end of the time here. I'd like a very quick view from you on this, Valerie, and because you said we'll always communicate. But I'm wondering, as we begin to interact with technology more, will we change why we communicate? Will we still need the communication to persuade somebody to do something, or to guide them to do something, or to ask them a question about something? Or will we hand some of that off to technology to do for us, like the weather, right? I don't call up Marco and ask him, is it raining today? I ask Siri, or he asks Siri. So will technology, we always ask, will technology replace work? Right, workers and some jobs. Will technology replace some of the need to communicate and the reasons why we do that?
Well, I think it will alter perhaps what we talk to each other about. But the fundamental act of communication is not about information. It's about social greasing. The reason we say, hey, how are you, isn't because those mean anything from a purely informational standpoint, but yet you're compelled to do it because from a social standpoint, that is fundamental to us as a species. So as long as we are still the same humans that we have always been, I don't think we'll ever lose the need to communicate. But as you said, what we communicate about might be different. But even with the weather, we still need someone doing the work to tell the models, here are the things you need to program in. So yes, I think there'll be more automation of those tasks. And of course that will affect jobs in some way. But in terms of our need to communicate from a social perspective, that is actually, I think, more extreme the more we interact with devices. Think about how hungry we are now for social interaction, because even when we are able to Zoom, it doesn't fulfill that need to actually be there in person, to be able to hug each other, to be able to read all the physical signs. As Marco said, we use our body language, use our facial expressions. We use a three-dimensional space when we communicate that we don't have in virtual forums. And so I think it will radically change business travel, because we can get more done in those contexts where it's not important, that social aspect, to the same degree. But still, things that are critical for persuasion will have to be done in person, because would you be persuaded by your computer? Probably not. It's not persuasive. And in fact, we find that even the types of language choices that you make can help or hurt persuasiveness. So we are very sensitive to how people ask us to do things. And it's those really subtle ways that we shape our communication, making these very, very subtle linguistic choices that we can't train a computer to do, right? Mathematical probabilistic models cannot explain to a computer why saying, so let's do this, is better than let's do this. Why some people might respond in a way that shows, oh, there was some intent to tie it together to what was said before. Or when I say, okay, so where are we going today? That I use a discourse marker, okay, to say, okay, I'm acknowledging you and where we were, and here I'm moving the conversation forward. Those are little things it's very hard to teach a computer to do. And it's fundamentally those little things that we find affect persuasiveness. So I don't think that those things can be trained into a computer, at least not in our lifetime. So yes and no, it will alter how we communicate and what we communicate about, but it will not alter the fact that we need that sort of face-to-face communication and speech to make things happen.
I love it. I love it. I wonder sometimes if artificial intelligence and machine learning and applied to speech will ever be fluent in sarcasm. Because I'm very, very, I really love that. So I'm like, you know, that influence, that accent, that expression on your face, even if it's something you say on a serious tone, but you're smiling, it changed the entire different thing. It's completely different. So with that said, we're marking on the 41 minutes. So I'm going to have to take the whip and and close this. Sorry, Sean, there's no more last question. We're famous for that one.
It's how I communicate.
Yeah, it's like Steve Jobs used to say, one more thing, you have one more question. Valerie, I want to thank you very much for a great conversation. As usual, I want to end this with, if we make people think, we were successful in this podcast. I also want to thank the Mentor Project, of which you are part. And yes, we didn't mention at the beginning, but this conversation is happening because of that wonderful organization that you're part.
Yes,
and exactly. And that Sean and I support 150%, maybe even more than that. And we're getting more and more involved with them as well. So we hope to have you again here. Maybe we'll target something a little bit more specific, like a little bit more focus on something. I think there are too many things right now to even try to wrap up this conversation. So I'm going to cut it right here. I want to thank you. I want to thank Sean for being part of this, of course. And again, the Mentor Project. And I hope to see you soon again and our audience to listen to us. Because again, this is an audio podcast, but we got to see each other. So I was thinking about that too, right? I mean, see, technology.
But, right.
But the voice hopefully will be enough to bring the point. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Valerie.
Thanks for having me.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. RSA Security offers business-driven security solutions that provide organizations with a unified approach to managing digital risk that hinges on integrated visibility, automated insights, and coordinated actions. Learn more at rsa.com. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.